My name is Phil Engstrom, and this is the session on modern cosmology. I perhaps should make a disclaimer at first, because I'm not a professional astronomer, but do take an interest in astronomy, and thought this might be a topic of some interest to some other people in the village, since we've been looking at stars on occasions in the evenings. Things in cosmology don't change very rapidly, generally. It takes a long time for the various theories of astronomy and how our universe is put together to take shape and finally to be substantiated. So when one speaks about modern cosmology, or cosmology today, this could include anything in the last 20 or 30 years, I suppose, because except for a few discoveries now and then that tend to change the perspective, the theories about the universe that are held today have been around for really a matter of 15, 20 years now, with, of course, some continuous adjustment. I thought at first I might just try to review a little bit something of the development of cosmology and astronomy, and remind you, if I may, a bit about the point of view that was held even as far back as the time of Kepler and Copernicus. Of course, at that time, it was believed that the Earth was at the center of things, that everything that was seen in the sky, the sun, all the planets, and the stars, somehow moved about the Earth, and therefore man was seen as at the very center of all of this grand scenery that we see in the sky. And then with the arrival of Copernicus and Kepler and Galileo on the scene, this particular point of view was destroyed. And there developed instead what we call the what came to be known as the heliocentric theory, the idea that the sun, rather than the Earth, is at the center of things, and that the Earth and the planets move about the sun. This took away a fair amount of the egocentricity that had belonged to man before, and it was partly because of this that Galileo got in trouble, though a number of historians in astronomy think that it was more Galileo's personality than it was what he said that caused the problem, because what he said had been said before him by Tycho Brahe, the Danish astronomer, as well as Kepler. But Galileo was a little bit irritating, and he was the one who had the telescope and could substantiate some of the things that had been said earlier. And he didn't always say them politely. And this, of course, got him into trouble with the church at that time. So possibly it wasn't so much his ideas as the way in which he presented them. Nonetheless, there was at this time this shift from an egocentric point of view, as we might say, to a less egocentric point of view of how the universe was put together. That was one of the most dramatic periods in the development of astronomy. And the second most dramatic period, I suspect, would have been between the years, let's say, 1910 and about 1930 or 1940, when a number of other very significant developments took place in the development of astronomy and cosmology. It began partly with a German astronomer as early as 1838. His name was Bessel, and by simple trigonometry was able to estimate with considerable success the distances of some stars. Now, you might think that's almost out of the question, but he, in observing, noticed that some stars, as the Earth moved about its orbit, seemed to remain stationary with respect to the vast number of stars in the sky. And he took that to mean that these stars were at a great distance, because their motions against the bulk of the sky was imperceptible. On the other hand, other stars, as the Earth moved about its orbit, appeared to shift position with respect to these background stars. So putting these two things together, he was able, by simple trigonometry and triangulation, to evaluate the distance of a number of stars with fair accuracy. That was the first success in determining some distances of stars. The first star he measured is a star in Cygnus, and he found that to be 11 light years away. That was a very remarkable achievement. And by the year 1900, he had found roughly 1,000 stars within distances of 100 light years, measured their distances with fair success. And then in 1908, a woman astronomer named Henrietta Leavitt, working at Harvard, began to observe what we call the Magellanic Clouds. Now, all of you are familiar with the notion of a galaxy. It's our star system. It's our home in the universe. But not far from our galaxy, which we call the Milky Way, are two relatively small collections of stars called the Magellanic Clouds. And she took an interest in these particular collections of stars. And she found that among the stars in these two clouds, particularly in the small cloud, there were some stars that changed their brightness. In fact, a number of them. She began to notice that in periods of, let's say, 3, 5, 7 days or so, they would vary in brightness significantly. Now, this was also a very remarkable discovery. And a young astronomer in California named Harlow Shapley took this, became curious in this, about this phenomenon, and went to the 100-inch telescope in Mount Wilson and began to calibrate and to chart the changes in brightness of these stars. And he found that not only were these kinds of stars found in this Magellanic Cloud, but there were a number of these kinds of stars that fluctuated in brightness among the stars that Bessel had worked with. And using these stars in the group that Bessel had worked with, and looking at his charts indicating the brightness and fluctuation of brightness, he discovered that these stars had a brightness that was directly tied to their period. So that by simply measuring the period of fluctuation in brightness, you could say what the intrinsic brightness of that star was. And knowing that, you could measure its brightness as seen from the Earth and determine that star's distance. All right?
The brightness independent of distance?
The brightness independent of distance from us was related to the frequency of pulsation of light. And then, so that if now you know the intrinsic brightness of a star, how bright it is if it were held at a average distance from you.
Is this an empirical relationship?
Yes, right, yes, that's right. This was an empirical relationship. He substantiated this for a large number of stars in the sky. So that now if he could find one of these kinds of stars, which are called Cepheid variables, they're all of short periods, You could, by means of tables and charts, determine the distance of these stars. Well, you can see how remarkably useful that was in determining distances in the universe, because that is a primary problem. How do you measure distances? And with this yardstick, he began to look at what we call the globular clusters. This had been another interest of his. And unfortunately, we haven't been able to have the telescope out recently, but I always show the group a globular cluster. This is a picture of one. It's a very dense collection of stars, and one of them in Hercules that we often look at has probably between 30 and 50,000 stars in it, densely packed together. And the one in Hercules happens to be about 33, 35,000 light years away from us. No, it's a globular cluster. It's not called a galaxy. It's within our own galaxy. It's a phenomenon that lies within our system of stars.
30, 40,000
stars. Yes, right.
how many stars in our galaxy?
Well, probably a billion of them. But that's, of course, a guess. An educated guess, but give or take a few.
And how many galaxies do they know there are?
Oh my, that's billions also. That's billions also. It's mind-boggling, that's right. But they estimate the number of stars in these, well, at least in our own universe, by counting those in a particular segment of the sky. Let's say an area of the sky, 1 square degree. And then you have to make some assumptions. You have to assume a certain kind of distribution in the sky. And then you simply, with multiplication, can get a reasonable estimate of the total number of stars. Well, Harlow Shapley began to look at these globular clusters. And he found that they contained a number of these Cepheid variables. And how handy that was. Now he could find the distances of these globular clusters. And he determined that they tended to lie around the fringe of our own galaxy. They tended to be distributed around the boundary of our own galaxy. Now, I think you've all seen pictures of galaxies. Ours is called the Milky Way, and it is a spiral galaxy. If we could get far enough away from it, it would probably look something like this. You see, with a dense center, and then spiraling arms reaching out from it. That's from the top, yes. We are about one-third of the distance from the center. One-third of the distance from the center out toward the edge. The diameter of our galaxy is about 100,000 light years. The center is roughly 20,000 light years across, and the sun is about 30, 35,000 light years from the center. And all of these measurements, or these initial measurements, were determined by Harlow Shapley in his study of the globular clusters. So with his work, there was quite an advance in getting some perspective about this star system in which we live. And by 1918, he had determined the distribution of about 25 of these known globular clusters, and ascertained what I just mentioned about the dimensions of our own galaxy. Now, the question still remained to people at that time, does this galaxy of ours we call the Milky Way contain everything we see? Shapley believed it did. He felt that everything you see in the sky belongs to the Milky Way. There was a very famous debate in Washington, D.C. in 1920, and the participants in the debate were Harlow Shapley and an astronomer named Huber Curtis, Shapley contending that everything we saw was in our galaxy, and Curtis saying, no, there are many of these fuzzy and indefinite objects we see in the sky that do belong to our Milky Way, but many that lie outside of it, beyond it. Well, this was really an expression of an idea that had been expressed first by a very famous British astronomer named William Herschel, who with a 48-inch telescope had researched the heavens in a dramatic way and found hundreds and hundreds of nebula, that is, somewhat cloudy objects in the sky that he could not identify perfectly. And he too contended that some of these lay in our galaxy and others were outside of our galaxy. That was in 1785. So he argued they needed larger telescopes to look at this more carefully. Well, after the debate of Shapley and Curtis, all the astronomers rushed back to their telescopes with a new project in mind to see whether they could determine whether all of these objects lay within our galaxy or not. And the man who did most of the research in this area, much of the fruitful research in this area, was a man named Edwin Hubble, whose name you may have heard. He too worked with the 100-inch Mount Wilson telescope. And this telescope was the large telescope that Herschel might have dreamed of, because with this telescope he was able to find in a nebula we today denote with as M33, that's its designation in one of the catalogs of nebula. He was able to find in this a star, mind you, that was a Cepheid variable, one of these pulsating stars, and was able to calculate the distance of this particular galaxy from the Earth and show conclusively that it lay outside of our own galaxy. And this was the first real solid evidence that our Milky Way did not contain everything that we see in the sky. He continued his research and found 100 such extragalactic, as they're called, systems outside of our galaxy. And in the second paper, he assumed that these nebula had about the same brightness. And by doing so, and using some estimates that Einstein had given for the radius of the universe, and doing some counting in various parts of the sky and assuming a kind of uniform distribution of these galaxies in the sky, he was able to conclude that there were about 3.5 times 10 to the 15th power nebula. Now that's 3.5 times 1 with 15 zeros after it. That many nebula. That's unbelievable. But that's by fairly rudimentary processes of counting, you know, and simply multiplying. So it's good old-fashioned arithmetic that's used in getting at these estimates. Now that's a number we can't imagine. Vast changes took place as a result of the work of these people. Tremendous changes. Whereas it had been assumed before that the matter we see is primarily confined to our galaxy, now it was understood that it belonged in a much, much greater universe. And furthermore, the people previous to this time had felt that the universe was essentially static. The stars were fixed. Now the stars were seen as pulsating. They were seen as in motion. And the entire business was seen as in constant motion, a very dynamic kind of universe. Along with this, Einstein was doing his work and developing his equations. And his first conclusion was that the universe was static. And then a Dutch astronomer named De Sitter came along and reworked Einstein's equations, made some adjustments, and concluded that was impossible unless there was no matter in the universe. So if there's matter in the universe, it has to be dynamic. And his conclusions, theoretical, turned out to be correct, of course. He even predicted the expanding universe that we're all familiar with. Then the last great discovery of that very fruitful period was made by an astronomer named Slepher, V.M. Slepher, who discovered in looking at stars and the galaxies through a spectroscope that the hydrogen line in the spectroscope, if you're familiar with spectroscopes, was shifted to the right, to the red end, rather, of the spectrum in many cases. If you've been into a science museum, you're very likely looked in a spectroscope. You'll have a flame out here that's burning some kind of element. You look through the spectroscope and you see in it a bunch of bright lines for an emission spectrum. And these lines correspond to the various elements that are found in the flame, like hydrogen and sodium and so on. And the universe is made primarily of hydrogen. So the hydrogen line is always a prominent one in spectroscopic observations. And Slepher found that these lines were often shifted. And study of this led the astronomers to conclude that the only thing this could mean was that things were receding from us in proportion to the displacement of this hydrogen line. Do you know what?
Speed then from that displacement.
Exactly. There's a direct correlation, a linear relationship between the displacement and the receding velocity. If you double the displacement, then the object you're looking at is going away twice as fast as the previous. With respect to us, of course, yes. Right. It's moving with respect to us. But this is an example of the Doppler effect in optics. Now, if you are standing by the highway with a flat tire and you listen to the cars passing by, you'll remember that those that approach you seem to have a higher pitch in their motors than those that are receding from you. They hear them as they go by. And the car that's going away from you down the road has a lower pitch than the one that's coming towards you. Well, this is the Doppler effect. The waves tend to become compressed as the object approaches you and tend to be stretched out as the object recedes from you. The same thing happens in optics. As a star or a galaxy recedes from us, the light waves are in a sense stretched out, and the frequency of those light waves seems to be less, or the wavelength seems to be longer. And it's this that's observed by the spectroscope. So that the spectroscope became a very useful instrument in measuring the velocities of objects. So now the universe is expanding. Well, that is pretty much background, but all of these elements still remain in our present understanding of the universe. 40 years ago, with a 200-inch Palomar telescope, it was estimated there were 2 billion. That we could see as far as 2 billion light years into the universe. Since that time, the advent of the radio telescope has changed things significantly as well, and has doubled or tripled the distance we can see into the universe. So now, with radio telescopes, astronomers can see 5 and 6 billion light years into the universe. It's still within the limits.
I mean, is it close to the limits?
No, possibly a half or 6/10 of the distance to the boundary.
Well, they think there's that much more.
Yes. Oh, yes. Right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So, yes, Einstein's equations have been adjusted a few times, but they're still the basis of all theoretical work in astronomy that attempts to ascertain any kind of boundary or limits for the universe. With photographic means, the faintest object that has been picked up so far is of magnitude 23, which is very, very faint. You couldn't begin to see that with your eyes. But now with radio telescopes, of course, we can see or pick out objects that are fainter than that. So that now it is, with radio telescopes, between 500 and 1,000 million galaxies are estimated in the visible universe as seen with radio telescopes. And so one of the basic questions of astronomy today is, how far can this process go? Each time we take the step in the direction of one magnitude, or each time we increase the efficiency of telescopes to determine objects one magnitude greater, we increase the number of galaxies countable by two or three times. If you can reach out farther to see a galaxy of magnitude 24, let's say, instead of 23, you will see in the heavens 2 to 3 times as many galaxies as a result of that better visibility. So that is one of the very basic questions that astronomers are researching today. And the second unsolved one concerns the matter of redshift. Astronomers, that is, this shift in the spectrum. Astronomers are convinced and satisfied with the use of the redshift as a means of measuring velocities out to 1/2 the speed of light, but they aren't certain about it beyond that. Once objects begin to recede at velocities greater than that, then they are uncertain about whether this particular phenomenon can be relied upon to tell the speed. Now, there are basically two kinds of models of the universe today. One of them is called the steady state model. I think you've all probably heard about the steady state model, which conceives of a kind of continuous flow of galaxies away from us, but a replacement of materials within the universe and the formation of new galaxies continuously. Somehow these galaxies move out and eventually drift beyond the horizon. I don't know. And at the same time, new galaxies are being created, and they enter into this flow and move outward as well. So it's a steady state. Right. That's right. Well, they're forming everywhere. They'll be forming everywhere. No. It's not like water bubbling up in the middle of a fountain and then flowing outward, but rather they're being formed everywhere. But this depends upon determination of whether there is, in fact, matter found between the galaxies, and that has not been decided yet. Some claim that there is matter there, and others say there isn't. So that's still an open question. But if there is sufficient hydrogen drifting around between the galaxies, then this becomes a possibility.
If it's there, what's it like? Is it suspension somewhere?
Yeah, well, it's like all the other objects in space. It's acted upon by various gravitational fields and in motion, but the distances are so huge that it exists in relatively free space without any obstructions. Yes? Well, there is one instance of a galaxy heading toward us, but that motion is because our own galaxy is rotating, and the sun is moving around the center of our galaxy, and the motion of the sun is what causes that apparent motion of this particular galaxy toward us. Otherwise, they all are, as far as we know, moving away from us.
But that steady state, where would the hydrogen come from?
Yes, I don't know. The steady state doesn't have the reputation that the other kind of the other theory has. model more often accepted among us astronomers is called the evolutionary model, and there are various kinds of this. model. One of them says that the universe is expanding, but as it expands to larger and larger dimensions, its rate of expansion slows down. Nonetheless, it extends out infinitely. Another one says that its rate of expansion will slow down to a certain constant value, but then remain fixed and then continue to expand indefinitely. And the third of these evolutionary models says that the universe will expand to a maximum, and then begin to contract, kind of a pulsating theory. Yes, that's the notion. To a very, very, very dense mass. and the which of these three kinds of evolutionary models is the right one, according to present theory, depends upon determination of certain constants. And these have not been determined yet. So much research is being invested in determining, for example, what is called the deceleration constant, a parameter. And if they could determine this, then astronomers claim they could settle on one of these three kinds of evolutionary models and decide whether the universe is going to expand indefinitely or whether it is indeed going to expand and then contract again. But
so some of these models regard the universe as without limits?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, a pulsar is a star that is sending out a radio signal of a very, very brief pulse, but possibly one signal every second and a half or so. And that appears to be due to the rotation of this star. It's a kind of star that seems to be rotating in such a way that each time it rotates, it sends out a brief pulse. Yes, they're small. They're small, very dense, but rotating very rapidly. Very rapidly.
Small compared to our sun.
Yes, right.
Smaller than the Earth
and
the Moon.
Well, not than the Earth, but between the Earth and the Sun. Very, very dense. Mm-hmm. That's at least one of the theories of the pulsar.
Just as dense as our sun.
What's that? Astonishingly dense, yes. Yeah. But not as dense as what are called the neutron stars. Normally, a star's life consists of, it begins with what's called a protostar. This is simply a result of the gathering together of a large amount of gas in some area in space, pulled together by gravitational attraction. Then this forms into a relatively dense mass and begins to glow. There is as yet no atomic reaction within the star. Yet, as time passes, the contraction continues, and finally atomic reactions will begin to take place within the nucleus of the star, the center of the star, converting hydrogen to helium. And during this time, the star is called a main sequence star. Then the helium is, for the most part, consumed, or the hydrogen, rather, and we have essentially helium. And then the star moves out of this class of main sequence stars and becomes hotter. The outer part of the star heats up and expands, and we have what's called a red giant. Then after that stage, after more, what's that?
Becomes hotter after
becomes the hotter yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. The center becomes hotter, but the
what if it supplies the energy for that?
That's a thermonuclear reaction within the star.
But what doesn't the thermonuclear have to go from hydrogen to
the helium begins to
go to what?
Go to heavier elements. They find some traces of iron, for example, in these stars. And then after the red giant stage, it becomes a white dwarf. Now that's true of a, then it continues to burn up its fuel and finally dies. It becomes a black dwarf. Not a black hole, but a black dwarf. Now, if the star has an initial mass of something greater than 1.4, the mass of the sun, that seems to be the critical mass, then when it gets to the white dwarf stage, instead of turning into a black dwarf, it reacts very violently. There's a tremendous explosion, and there appears what's called a supernova. And then after that, it begins to die. On the other hand, if the star has an initial mass of, let's say, 50 times the sun's mass, then still a third kind of phenomenon happens. Now when the star becomes a white dwarf, the contraction of gravity is so intense that the electrons and the protons in the nucleus of that star are compressed to the point that they become what are called neutrons. And we have a neutron star, which is astonishingly dense, so that a spoonful might weigh tons and tons. And these are, of course, so dense you cannot imagine what they are like. And these may also explode in a cataclysmic sort of way, throw off half of their mass, and leave a residue that is a smaller neutron star. They of course, are very curious items, and there are none that have been photographed. Though there is one star, I think it's in the constellation of Cygnus again, a red giant, which appears to have a companion star that is a neutron star. But these are the result, to a large extent, of theoretical work. So, the quasars are quasi-stellar radio objects. That's where the name comes from, quasi-stellar radio sources. And what they are is not known exactly, but they are at the extremities of the visible universe and are of very high energy and often emit radio signals. Some are called quiet quasars. These do not emit radio signals, but most of them do emit... What's that? They're not visible with telescopes. They have received X-ray and gamma ray signals from some of them, rather than radio. Yes, they do. I'm not familiar to what extent they do. They are really a puzzle to modern astronomers. They had hoped that the quasars, being so far away, would help to answer this question about the red shift matter, because the red shift in observing these is tremendous. Tremendous.
Which brings up another question. Is there any red shift greater than the speed of light?
None to this time, no.
No.
No, theoretically, no.
Well, that's a problem. Even just the shift is constant speed of light.
Now, the most rapidly receding objects so far have a speed of about 8/10 the speed of light, 0.8. And these are the quasars.
Is there any theory? What happens if it does go faster than speed of light?
Well, there are theories, but I don't know what to make of them. I can't handle that stuff.
From each other at half the speed of light, but from
Yes, uh-huh. Yes,
in which case you never find it, because why you never get to it.
Yeah, well, right.
No, that's not what it says, though. But they measure the speed of light of an object going away or coming to you is the same.
So that's a consequence of Einstein's.
That's right. In other words, if the object is going away from you, or if it's coming towards you, the speed of its light, as you measure it, is the same. Try and think about that one. That's Einstein.
Then you wouldn't have a red shift.
You only have the red shift up to half, is what he's saying.
No.
This red shift, though, Phil, is not based on the velocity of light, isn't it?
No.
Isn't it the wavelength?
That's right, yes.
It's not the velocity.
That's not a relativistic sort of thing.
No, it's not. It's the velocity of the light, isn't it?
No. No, it's the shift of the frequency and the wavelength rather than the velocity.
The velocity of the light is weird.
Well, that's right. Then you get into contraction of lengths and such things, and slowing down of clocks and all of that, which is... they're only confident with it at speeds less than that. They aren't certain whether they can rely upon this particular yardstick once the speeds become greater than that. But I'm not sure why they are in doubt beyond that point. But they, yes?
As far as the light and red shift, is there an absolute zero in velocity? Or can they even say that one is existing? If the star was moving zero velocity, where would the hydrogen spectrum line be?
Right, exactly where it should be. Along the scale in the spectroscope.
Burn some hydrogen right on Earth.
If you do it in the laboratory, then you get a particular spectrum, and the hydrogen will be placed right here. If you photograph a star, there'll be a shift toward the red end of that particular of that line.
Is the picture you gave of formation of stars, the scattering of gases and that, is that how widely accepted is that? Is there anyone arguing with that picture of star formation, saying that it's done some other way?
No, I don't know of any arguments with that. That seems to be accepted. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You didn't talk about black holes.
Well, yes, well, they are somewhat like the neutron stars in that the gravitational attraction is so great that it overcomes any light that may be trying to get out. What happens inside of a black hole, astronomers say, is inside the event horizon. That is, it's over the horizon, so you can't see it, you see, because no light can get out to tell you what's going on. You can't tell what's going on unless you get some light from the particular area. And hence they're called black holes, because nothing can escape. No, nothing gets out, nothing at all. And it sucks everything into it. Well, you can't see them as a blank spot, no. They're highly theoretical. Except that I did mention this one example of the supergiant. That could be a neutron star or could be a black hole, because there is some evidence that this particular second star in this system seems to be sucking a lot of stuff away from from the red giant. Right, just absorbing it.
So the reality is largely, that you describe, is largely a mathematical construct.
Much of it is that.
The same way when we go into the atom.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And there'll be a little photograph with a little trace on it, which may be highly significant, and then it goes into a complex mathematics, and then out of that comes these stories. And the reasonableness some of the stuff that they come out with on that sounds totally unreasonable from our experience at this intermediate size.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
The small or the big size, and stuff doesn't seem to make sense.
Well, you know, they've taken pictures of the black holes and everything, and you know, you can look around it and there's stars all over, but then right there, it's just nothing.
Of black holes, I don't know of any photographs of them. There are dark nebula, you know. What's that?
Well, I think what Lauren's saying is if there were a field of stars behind a black hole,
mm-hmm.
that what you would notice is kind of a black hole.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
All the light would be sucked in.
Yeah.
I was even reading that they thought that these things were so big that one has even struck the earth in some of these great calamities, you know, like in Siberia, I figured what might have hit there.
If a black star hit, it hit the earth would not be. I think they said the density, someone said, I think the density of the world's steel output would be the size of an egg or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah,
there's more to get here. This path will blow up.
Astonishing densities. See, normally inside of matter, there is distance between the nucleus of an atom and the electrons. But in these particular phenomenon, that law is overridden, and all of this material is compressed tightly, so that you have. All of these neutrons right up against one another without space in between them. Actually, the universe is mostly space. You know, there's if you distributed all of the mass of the universe uniformly, you wouldn't have more than perhaps an atom or so per cubic yard. Really very, very sparsely distributed. In fact, the mass of the universe is another subject that's of considerable interest, because if you could calculate the mass of the universe, you could decide to a large extent whether it is going to collapse or continue to expand. If the mass is larger than a particular critical value, I don't recall what it is now, then astronomers believe that there will be sufficient gravitational attraction within that universe to cause the whole thing to contract back into a black hole. Yes, well, they know, they have the stars fairly well classified. They've studied our own sun to a great extent. They know its mass, and there is a relationship between mass and brightness. Mass and brightness.
Yes, distance and brightness.
Yes, without those, it would be impossible. Of course, laws of motion also are used. That is, the orbit that a star might have in our own galaxy is also used to corroborate information that's obtained by other means. But astronomers today, I think, are, an essay by Bernard Lovell, who is perhaps one of the world's leading astronomers today, and he assesses astronomy today by saying that astronomers today are very, very humble people. He says that despite all of the grand techniques and technologies and theories, it seems like every advance leads to so many more problems. So many of these questions are really unsettled. There is, he said, some pessimism among astronomers because they have been unable to solve some of these very mind-boggling questions. And yet they are astonished that often their theories do find substantiation in observation. Well, I don't know how one imagines the things that belong to astronomy. They're really beyond our imaginations, I think. There's also another interesting conjecture that that if one accepts this notion of an expanding and contracting universe, and supposing that the universe contracts into some black hole someday, then it may emerge again from that black hole. Will that universe be the same? And there is an astronomer at Princeton, name is Wheeler, I believe, who has said that the universe we have has a unique collection of laws and physical constants, and that we are about 1/10 of the way toward full expansion. The universe will then contract into a black hole, and then a new universe will emerge that may have entirely different physical laws, different physical constants, and perhaps constants and laws that are not hospitable toward life at all. And he claims that it's simply a matter of kind of selection, a natural selection of constants and laws that has brought about a condition favorable to life in this universe. Well, that
you'd almost have to assume that if you're going to have that pulsating universe, because the second law of thermodynamics would be violated if it both contracted and then came back to what it was before.
Yeah.
So you almost, yeah. I mean, we have laws that say that either the law has to be changed or you can't do that.
Well, we were talking before we began here about this film Cosmic Zoom, which begins with a photograph of a fisherman on a lake, and then backs up and you see the man and the boat and finally the whole lake and the forest and the city and then the world and then the moon and the planets and the sun. Finally you're out in the universe looking back to to the earth, and then it comes back in again on the man, to his hand, to a mosquito, to a blood cell, down into the cell, and goes the other direction, and very effectively shows something of man's relationship in this magnificent creation that we have, something of the extremes that we find in astronomy and in subatomic research.
They say our body is about the intermediate size between the smallest known.
Well, I've seen scales, you know, 10 to the first power, 10 to the second power, and so on, and then 10 to the minus first, 10 to the minus second, and placing man somewhere.
Some ultimate building block. We used to think the atom, and then of course the proton, neutron, electron, and now the quark. But maybe there isn't. I mean, you just keep breaking down small. And maybe the other way too. You think that we're part of a solar system, which is part of a galaxy, and the galaxy is part of the universe. The universe, what's that part of? It's just kind of like an open-ended on both ends of the scale.
And no matter which way we go, our imaginations are stymied, I think. You can't imagine a universe that's not bounded, and you can't imagine one that is bounded. Yeah. Neither one matches our ways of thinking. Well, there is so much mystery, that's right. You know, we are continually confronted with mystery. I mentioned the other day that I'd run across a statement some time back that intrigued me. Said, the larger the island of knowledge, the longer the shoreline of mystery. Yeah. Isn't that a nice statement? Which really is something I've thought about very often. Well, thank you so much for coming.